easy, and it's always free. Just call 1-855-573-8227 or visit kpft.org to donate your old vehicle. Thanks for your support. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Beep, 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 yeah! 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 Beep, 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 beep,
program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on Houston Community Radio, KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host, Mary Edgerton, along with an ensemble of gifted hosts, Hank Rubicek, our producer and show's founder, Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and Warren Holland, our master of wellness. These guys are not only gifted hosts, but they are also great storytellers themselves. We also have a wonderful group of guest hosts who grace our show. Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman, Eric Heen, Paul Topikian, and Tatiana Gago. Truly a wonderful group to spend an evening with. Together with our guest storytellers that we bring on the show every week, we celebrate the magic and the power of storytelling. Storytelling takes you on distant trips and then brings you back safely to the present. It's magical. And whenever magic is in the air, you can expect the unexpected. Well, sometimes the unexpected isn't the positive experience that we want. Both 2020 and 2021 have been very unexpected and very difficult. Just about 1 year ago, our lives were turned upside down with the COVID pandemic. Starting 2021, there was the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Adding to that, for us in Texas, was Storm Uri, leaving us without power while temperatures were in the mid-teens. That, I can tell you, is very unexpected for this part of Texas. Hence, these days, we feel out of control. Now, speaking of control, I asked two guests to come on the show and tell a story about losing control, specifically about eating disorders. Well, what is control but control of our own emotions and responses? I have two wonderful women tonight here, a scientist and a physician, to tell you the story that dates from their meeting and working together in a lab in the earlier part of the 21st century, to a point where Lauren Badaluco, one of our guests, now working in a cancer research facility in Boston, realized that she had an eating disorder. Amy Spallone, who is currently completing her training as an infectious disease specialist, met her while they worked together at the lab in New York. Amy was a medical student and Lauren was an undergraduate. They have two different viewpoints of this story. For Lauren, what began as a search for discipline became a journey into losing control over her body image, her weight, and her eating. Amy, as the outside observer, becomes the narrator, telling us how she saw her friend changed from such a happy person into a person who seemed to be losing herself. So Lauren is our traditional protagonist and will tell us from the first person perspective what she felt was happening. This is a very important story, especially right now, so relevant to our lives in 2021, as we have had strong control issues as our world has changed. In fact, it is said that eating disorders have thrived during the pandemic. and I am not surprised. Well, let's start now with how the two of you met each other. Amy, tell us about that lab and a story that will introduce us to Lauren as you first met her.
Thanks, Mary. So to do this, I'm going to take us all the way back to the summer of 2012. I had just finished my first year of med school at Albany Med, and I had this real short summer break coming up. By short, I mean like it was going to be about 8 weeks, and arguably this is going to be the last official summer break of my life as a student. So of course, I decided to spend it working in a basic science lab. And to be honest, I was a little apprehensive when I was joining this lab. As Lauren can tell me, and Mary, you as well, I know you have experience working in labs. Labs are like any other really close work environment. You get this mix of personalities and egos, and they either thrive or they implode under the pressures of the job. So needless to say, I was a little nervous joining a new lab, being the new kid. I had been in one other basic science lab before that when I was an undergrad. I pretty much can sum up my time in that lab as these long periods of loneliness punctuated by moments of sheer panic. At the time, I was studying rust fungus on willow that was being used for biofuel. And it was really just me alone with a bunch of plants in a greenhouse for stretches of hours at a time. And I remember doing a lot of running around and thinking to myself, oh my God, I don't actually know what I'm doing. So, and of course it didn't help at this point. For my project, I was tasked with running this multi-million-dollar scanning electron microscope that my PI at the time told me in a very matter-of-fact way, if you break it, just don't come back. So anyway, here I am now joining another lab. It's my first day, and I go in to meet my PI, Dr. Karin Deuce. And Karin was wonderful. She was so welcoming, and she was clearly very patient with me. You know, we talked about my project and what my goals were for the summer. She then showed me around the lab, and it was a small lab. It was only about three or four benches. We were a small HIV research lab. So of course, as part of my tour, I got to peek my head in our little BSL2 area that was partitioned with this beaded curtain in the lab. And for those of you who don't know, BSL2 means biosafety level. And the two just designates the level of the biosafety level. For labs that do research in infectious and deadly pathogens, they have to maintain certain levels of safety and precautions to keep their working environment safe for people in the lab, but also for the community. An easy example is something like a Ebola virus, which I think everyone knows popularized in different movies and on television shows. Those have to be handled in what we call a BSL-4. It's the highest safety level. It's a very contagious and highly lethal pathogen. So of course, people who work in labs with Ebola walk around in these spacesuits all day long. Well, for us in our HIV lab, we did have to wear, you know, special extra protection, but it wasn't anything like what someone working with Ebola would be doing. So anyway, I got to look around and got introduced to all the safety measures for the lab. At the end of my tour, Karin introduced me to the rest of the lab. So in no particular order, I got to meet her lab tech, Heather, her graduate student, Princess, her postdoc, Kristen, and then her lab director and husband, Walt. And at that moment, I felt like I had just joined the Yaya Sisterhood of Science. We became this instant family. We worked really hard that summer, but we supported each other along the way, and we had a lot of fun doing it. A couple of weeks after I started, Karin told us that we'd be having an undergrad student join us for the summer, and that's actually how I met Lauren. Actually, my first memory of Lauren was hearing her before I actually saw her, and that's because she was laughing. She had this sort of contagious belly laugh that was very loud, but in this wonderful way where she just seemed to be this vessel of happiness that was always on the verge of bubbling over. And I was super excited. I was finally not going to be the new kid in the lab anymore, and I got a chance to show someone else the ropes and teach her all the little tricks I had figured out at that point. So we were stuck at the hip for a few weeks after she joined. And Lauren integrated immediately into our lab sisterhood. And we basically spent that summer becoming really good friends. And, you know, in as much as we were working hard, we also were playing hard as well. We would have karaoke style music jams in the lab while we were working, or stop for the occasional impromptu photo shoot. We'd also make a lot of coffee runs across the street to Starbucks that summer. Some of my best memories actually from medical school are when I was working in Karin's lab with Lauren and the rest of the girls. Here is going to be my last summer break ever, and I was super excited to spend it working in this lab every day. And even on our days off, we'd all hang out And we'd go on excursions like to the park theater for a show and a picnic, or we'd spend a Saturday drinking sangria or doing crafts at Karen's house. So needless to say, life was really good that summer. And by the end of that summer, I actually could do an RNA extraction in my sleep. I had perfected a sangria recipe, and I became friends with a gang of the most genuine and hardworking, dedicated women scientists that I'd ever met. I continued to work off and on in Karen's lab through the next few years until I graduated and went off to residency. I did my residency in Stony Brook on Long Island, and the reason I ended up in Stony Brook was because Lauren had told me all about it, and that was where she was doing her undergraduate school. And so she kind of gave me a peek behind the curtain, so to speak. So now fast forward to 2016, I'm in residency and I'm getting married in the fall. So I decided I needed to start an Instagram account. And at some point on there, I end up finding Lauren again. You know, we had been out of touch for a couple of years at that point, but we ended up reconnecting. And since I had last seen or spoken to her, I saw that she had graduated college. She had gotten a job in a lab. And it looks like she was starting to really get into health and fitness and try to change her life. Like, for example, I saw she was participating in this long distance cross country bike trip, and I love road cycling. So, of course, it's like, oh, it's awesome. I'll follow Lauren as she posts on her trip across the country. I get to live vicariously through her. I mean, this is a major bucket list item for myself. And, you know, over the next year or two, I continued to check in and see what she was up to. And I saw that her posts started to change a little bit. And it was clear that she had gotten very serious about her fitness and that she was starting to become a runner. Like, so for example, instead of a lot of goofy pictures of Lauren with her friends or with her dog, it was more like photos of a plate of healthy looking food or a photo of her running watch showing her pace and time. She also started posting a few before and after type pictures showing her progress on weight loss. And by 2018, the effects of this exercise and weight loss were really striking to the point where sometimes I'd be scrolling through photos and not even recognize her in the pictures. Once I would realize I was actually looking at a picture of Lauren, my immediate thought was, whoa, she's gotten so thin and I hope she's doing okay. Because it seemed to me that this was beyond the point of weight loss just from being a more active, healthy person. And actually, she didn't actually look all that healthy or that strong anymore as I thought someone who might be training for a distance event would look. And I just wondered what was going on the other side of the camera.
Wow. First, I have to say, what a wonderful lab you worked in. I so wish I could change my past life with yours. That sounds great. But let's go to you now, Lauren. So we met you and you were the woman with the belly laughs. You were hilarious. And then you graduated from college and you're feeling on top of the world and you're getting ready to take this cross-country bicycle trip. So tell us your side. What happened to you in these years?
Yeah. So first of all, Amy, thank you for that really awesome introduction. Truly, that was an extremely amazing undergrad lab experience that I had. And Amy basically taught me everything I know about pipetting to this day. I still think about her every time I open up a reagent to mix up a little bit with my pipette tip. She taught me how to use MasterMix, and I don't think I've messed up a PCR since I met her, and Mary also for having us on the show. After I had met Amy and joined this Yaya Sisterhood of Science and completed my undergraduate degree from Stony Brook, I had my BS in biology, and I kind of felt like I was at this crossroads. I had actually applied for a PhD program, and I didn't get in. So from there, I was kind of trying to decide, you know, did I want to pursue medical school still, or did I want to pursue grad school? But the one thing I did know was that I had a lot of time, and this time I probably would never have ever again in my life. So I signed up to do this crazy thing to ride my bicycle across the country. And when I say crazy, I really mean it was crazy because I did not even own a bicycle at the time. I probably had not been on a bicycle in at least 2 years. And I did not even cycle seriously. For all you cyclists out there, the road shoes that you clip in to your bicycle with, I learned how to use those the day we left on our trip. But I really loved the organization, the Ullman Cancer Fund for Young Adults. They do a lot of really great things for young adults facing a cancer diagnosis that goes beyond research. They deal with things like fertility preservation and college scholarships and all those types of things. So yeah, I did this bike ride. It was amazing.
That is really something I have to say. When I was in my 20s, actually in the middle of a couple of postdocs myself, a boyfriend was trying to talk me into doing a cross-country ride in the United States with him. And I just was, you know, we had gone on many bike trips together in England, but I was said, in the United States, they run you over when you're on a bicycle. I was absolutely terrified. Not to mention the fact that when we rode together in England, I would do 100 miles one day, 50 the next, about 25 the next, and maybe 10 the next. And I couldn't imagine sustaining 100 miles a day. So tell us about that trip.
Yeah, you'd be amazed, honestly, at what your body can adapt to when you're, you know, fueling it properly and, you know, training that way. And biking is really great on your joints. So, you know, you shouldn't count it out. You should still go for that US ride if you ever decide to. But yeah, so I mentioned the organization before, but they are the Ullman Cancer Fund for Young Adults. And they also have some other programs that are still ongoing right now. I'm actually involved in one. It's called Cancer to 5K. And it's basically a program that's 12 weeks long for people who are, you know, currently undergoing treatment or have just finished treatment and want to get back into running or be active again. And we run a 5K together at the end. I've met a lot of really inspiring people there, but the ride is called 4K for Cancer. So you basically fundraise $1 per mile. It's really amazing. My particular ride, we started in Baltimore, Maryland, and we ended in San Diego, California, 70 days later. We took the weirdest route that you could think of to go across the country by starting completely south all the way to Florida and hugged the coast until we got to Texas. And we shot up through Texas, went into the Rocky Mountains in Colorado a little bit. And then we went back down into Arizona and we got to see the Grand Canyon, which I embarrassingly thought was just a hole in the wall, or sorry, a hole in the ground. And it is definitely not. It's amazing. We slept on church floors. We camped. We slept in people's homes. We slept on YMCAs. We totally roughed it. We also volunteered in hospitals along the way. We did some bone marrow drives and just kind of spread the goal of this really incredible organization. And before I'd done the bike trip, I'd always been kind of an active person. Before that, I'd played a lot of softball and some other sports growing up. And I was in marching band at Stony Brook, which, you know, don't judge a book by its cover there. It gets really intense. You are wearing like the worst material uniforms that many, many other people have worn in the past. You're out in the sun or the freezing cold in the middle of this football field trying to play an instrument and march around. So it gets intense, but you know, I'd never been into fitness. I wasn't actively building muscles or counting my protein or anything. It was social for me. But one side effect of, you know, biking 100 miles a day, every day for 70 days straight and kind of living off of literally whatever scraps of food that we could get into our bodies, to be in my, you know, early 20s again and be able to stomach that. But, you know, one side effect was weight loss. So I wasn't what you would consider in like a super larger body, but you could definitely notice when I finished the ride and I started to get a lot of compliments on it. People were saying things like, oh my gosh, where did the rest of you go? And oh my gosh, you are so skinny. You look amazing. As if I didn't look amazing before. Just, you know, things like that. And these are things that we kind of hear every day that you might not even think twice about. And I certainly wasn't at the time, but, you know, here I am now. I'm on the receiving end of these compliments and they really start to feel good. I just finished this amazing ride. I felt really strong. I ended up getting a job in Boston at Dana-Farber, which is an incredible research institution, with someone I actually did the bike trip with. But after that bike trip, I obviously wasn't biking 100 miles a day anymore, and my body just slowly kind of went back to how it was. And it continued to be like that until a couple years later, I end up breaking up with my then boyfriend, who I'd been dating for a long time, 4 years. And I had also left my job at Dana-Farber for a new job in industry. And I was not up to speed yet, for sure, in that job. And I just felt, well, here I am again at this crossroads. And I think now would be a great time to mention that I have some generalized anxiety. And I think that anxiety shows up differently for everyone. So I can only speak for myself when I say that when I feel more in control, I feel less anxious. In reality, I am mostly in control about how I react to what's happening and less about controlling what's actually happening to me. But, you know, control feels good to me. I feel less anxious when I'm in control. So what do? I decide to do what I did when I graduated college. I started to work out and really, you know, focus on cleaning up what I ate a little bit. And it started off totally well-intentioned. I wanted to get that control and strength back. And just with little changes, I started running again, eating more fruits and vegetables. And again, it happened. I started to lose weight and it felt good. But then it kind of spiraled from there. And I totally throw myself into this fitness life. I ended up downloading this app to count my calories. And I started just logging every single thing that went into my mouth. And I mean everything. Like if someone offered me a bite of, you know, a candy bar or an unexpected brownie at work, like it's someone's birthday, I would log it as a fourth of a candy bar or a fourth of a brownie. And even when I was baking the potentially dangerous raw cookie dough batter that is the best part of baking that you lick off the spoon, I would log that. I would put that in my calorie counting app. And people just kept saying those things again, like, oh, you look amazing. And I wish I had your willpower. And those things only started to just fuel what I was feeling and made me worse. I actually started saying no to going out with my friends because I couldn't eat out with them because I didn't know what they were eating. It didn't fit my eating plan. My resting heart rate hovered around 39 beats per minute. And I was proud of that. I thought, you know, I'm this really fit runner now. And I have this extremely low resting heart rate. This is great. But, you know, pretty soon I was so thin and dangerously so that nothing just fit me anymore. And I would start losing these chunks of hair in the shower. I would just run my fingers through my hair and chunks would fall out. And I thought that was normal. And I was wearing fleece jackets in the middle of July in the summer because I was freezing cold. I could never get warm. My fingers would turn purple inside of air conditioning places. And I think the worst thing was when I lost my period. And for some context, your body on a biological level is really happy to just keep you healthy so that someday, if you choose, you can reproduce. So when you lose your period, when your body shuts down its reproductive parts of you, that is its Hail Mary. It is its final pass. It's doing everything it can to keep you going. And right around then is when I started to feel like, you know, this is wrong, but I just couldn't stop.
Wow. That's amazing. And thank you for sharing some of those personal parts of it, because you did mention before that the foundation you work with helps cancer patients with reproductive issues. So we all know that's a very personal feeling, whether or not you choose to use mm-hmm. them, but to own them is a very personal thing. And to have your body say, nope, you're just not healthy enough to do this. So what was it like trying to go out with people and have fun and keep this calorie count going?
I wasn't having fun. I remember this holiday party I had at work and we all wanted to go to an after party, but I didn't go. I didn't drink alcohol anymore because it was liquid calories. It wasn't adding to my diet. So I wasn't having fun. I couldn't.
Did you allow yourself any sweets, any special? I mean, if you pass by a bakery and you see a beautiful cupcake, could you allow yourself?
You know, I guess a story that sticks out to me around that is when I was really sick, or when I was getting to my sickest, I went to Disney World with my siblings and I was really excited. We are huge Disney nerds and I had this great job now and I could afford to bring both of them. And I was really happy to do it and it was really exciting. And when you go to Disney, you go, you know, not just for the rides and for, you know, the themes and all that, but you go to eat some good food. But I was so, so deep in this eating disorder. And I just felt like I was controlling everything and I needed to control everything. And our first night there, we went out to dinner to the downtown Disney area, Disney Springs, I think it is now. And we're just wandering around trying to find something to eat. And my siblings and I passed this cupcake place called Sprinkles that we had, you know, wanted to try a cupcake from for a very long time. So, you know, they're like, oh, let's get cupcakes after dinner. Like totally normal thing to do. But for me, that was not in my planned day of eating. So instead of just enjoying walking around Disney that first night with my siblings who are laughing, having an amazing time, they're drinking everything in, we're all picking at our Mickey Mouse ears, I'm nose deep in my calorie counting app, moving things around, trying to take things away, and, you know, trying to decide what I could take out of my planned eating day so that after dinner, I could just fit one half of a cupcake. I just felt like all day, I needed to starve myself just to do that.
Wow. So that sounds like almost an addiction rather than self-control, really.
Yeah.
We are going to take a break for station identification just now. And then we'll come back to listen to more of Lauren's story from herself and Amy's perspective of it as her friend, the narrator. This is Mary Edgerton, or as I like to call myself, Mary E., and we are here on So What's Your Story, broadcast live every Thursday at 8 p.m. on Houston Community Radio. And you can find it on your dial at 90.1 FM in Houston or live streaming from kpft.org. We look forward to our weekly show and the opportunity to be an important part of the Houston storytelling scene. So let me put on my social media hat and say something about the show. If you don't have a radio, it's no excuse for missing the show. We're broadcast from the website over the internet as the show is happening. Unfortunately, not live, but what I like to call near live these days. And if you don't catch it Thursday nights at 8 p.m., you can always find the podcast either on kpft.org or permanently on houstonstorytellers.org. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. You can also visit our Facebook page during the week preceding the show and get an idea about what we're up to. You never know. And this time we want to add something extra. We want to have some pictures for you of Amy and Lauren from the lab and from some of Lauren's experiences after to chronicle the story. Now, here in Houston, time and stories are not stopped by a pandemic. So let's review what's happening in our storytelling community. Our show's sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, hosts a virtual story swap on the fourth Tuesday of every month. The Houston Storytellers Guild is a great way to develop your stories, either as a beginner or as an experienced storyteller trying out a new idea. March's Zoom Story Swap was just this last Tuesday, March 23rd, so the next will be April 27th. They post the Zoom meeting room on their website in the events calendar at houstonstorytellers.org. That's one word, no periods, no caps, just houstonstorytellers.org. So don't ignore it just because the link says Temple Emmanuel. Click on the link and it will give you the virtual swap site for joining in over the waves. This move to virtual storytelling and story swaps because of the pandemic has its pluses and minuses. Although we are not seeing each other live in the studio, it is possible now to join many storytelling venues online around the state and the country. The San Antonio Storytellers Association also has a story swap night now held virtually the first Wednesday of every month. The Zoom meeting opens at 6:30 and storytelling is from 7 to 8. So check out sanantoniostorytellers.com for more info. The 36th Annual Storytelling Festival in Denton, Texas was just held virtually March 11th to 14th. So again, we're making the best of it in terms of being able to experience other people's stories. I hope some of you were able to attend that. Some of the great headliners were Heather Forrest, Ethnotech, Donna Washington, and Sam Payne. So at some point, I really want to hear about this. Just post on the Facebook page if you were able to join that one. Our friends at the Moth have also been hosting virtual events based on your time zone. Buy your tickets early because they do sell out. So check that out on The Moth, one word, themoth.org. And while you're filling up your calendar with all these storytelling shows, don't forget that So What's Your Story? We'll be back next Thursday, 8 p.m. on Houston Community Radio at 90.1 FM or kpft.org with a new show.
And next week, who do we have on? It's going to be Hank Rubichek back again. And he's going to be bringing on some kids from Meyerland to tell stories. That's always a lot of fun. So definitely come back and join us next Thursday at 8 p.m.
Now that we've talked about storytelling, I'd like to get back to our storytellers. And Lauren, just before our break for station identification, Amy told us about the changes that she saw after finding you again. And you talked about the extreme control issues, almost addiction you were having to calorie counting. Were you happy?
I think on the outside, it was really easy to look at me and, like Amy had said before, see all these things that I was posting and, you know, all this, you know, quote unquote success I was having with my weight loss, all the before and afters. But honestly, I was not happy at all. I was very, very depressed. I had gotten really deep into this eating disorder where I just knew at this point that nothing was ever going to be good enough. I knew that I was doing something unhealthy and bad for me at the time, but all I felt emotionally at that point was panic. I thought that if I stopped doing what I was doing, that I would let myself go or get out of control or gain all this weight back again, which, you know, I thought at that time would just be the worst thing in the world to gain weight. So I just kept doing it. And, you know, I tried to kind of get myself out of it a little bit by myself. You know, like Amy had said, I'd taken up running and I'd been running kind of casually while I was still restricting and dieting. But I decided to, you know, let's just keep going with this running thing and let's sign up for a marathon. So I did it. I signed up for the Philadelphia Marathon to run it in November of 2018. And for people looking for a first marathon out there, please run Philadelphia. It's amazing. But, you know, at the same time, I had actually started my Instagram account, and that account is Recovery Runs on Bagels. And that is probably the one that Amy had found after my personal Instagram. And, you know, if you have an Instagram, please go visit it. I post a lot of great things for people going through the same thing that I might have gone through. And, you know, there's a lot of support over there. But the name Recovery Runs on Bagels was kind of a play on me wanting to recover from an eating disorder, and recovery runs, which are just really nice, easy, fun runs that you do after a long or hard workout to kind of just get yourself feeling loose again. And of course, bagels, which if you know me, they are my absolute favorite food. So thus the name Recovery Runs on Bagels was born. But of course, because of the level I was at with obsessing about my food and obsessing with my weight, I, of course, became instantly obsessed with training. I did not miss a run, even if it meant I did do this, waking up at 3 a.m. before a flight or, you know, something else absurd to go for a run. either on a treadmill, or one time I'd actually gotten up at 3 a.m. and ran in unfamiliar streets in Baltimore, which as a woman running, it's very unsafe to do that. But I was just, I had to get my run in. And of course I was not properly fueling myself to train for a marathon. So I just kept getting sicker and thinner. And finally, you know, the marathon's coming up. All these 18 weeks of training is culminating to this amazing moment. And I had spent a night in my hometown at my parents' house because I was going to drive down with them to Philadelphia from where I grew up in upstate New York around Albany, where the lab Amy and I were in together. This was a couple days before the marathon. And I remember this next moment so clearly in my head. It feels like yesterday, and I will never forget it. I went to go take a shower, and you know, a shower, everyone takes a shower, so mundane. And I stepped on the scale, as I did fairly frequently back then. I don't really step on the scale anymore unless I'm going to a doctor's appointment. And even then, sometimes I ask to not know the number, which you can do at your doctor's appointments. You don't have to know. But I stepped on the scale and I saw that I was now 98 pounds on my 5'4 body. And I could not believe I was seeing that number. I had the strangest mix of feelings. I immediately felt this instant like thrill, like, oh my God, I'm 98 pounds. Like I've made it. I am below 100 pounds. I'm 98 pounds. That was absolutely my eating disorder voice. But then, you know, almost immediately after that, I had this extreme feeling of, oh my God, I am 98 pounds. And I was filled with a mixture of guilt and shame. I was just filled with it. I knew that this was not good. I knew I was beyond healthy at this point, but I could not stop. So I went and I ran my first marathon weighing 98 pounds. And to this day, I thank my body for getting me through that. I really, really don't know how I did it because it just wasn't okay. I was not in a good place. But my body was and continues to be resilient, and somehow I did make it through. But the feeling was numbed. You know, for people out there who run marathons, your first marathon is supposed to be exciting. Like, you know, you've worked really hard to do this. You've trained, and now's the time. It's the victory lap, we call it. We call it the victory lap for your training. But I was just hoping I was going to make it alive. You know, but I did. And after that marathon, I got, if it was even possible, even more depressed. I'm still restricting my food, but now the training is gone. So I'm restricting even more because I didn't feel like I earned even the small amounts of extras that I was giving myself during training. And I start to really panic now. And I'm wondering if I'll gain weight now again, like as if that was the worst thing in the world. And I knew I was sick, but I couldn't let go of that feeling of thinking that I had control. It's just all about control. And about a year before that, I had actually started dating someone else. His name is Brian. And after the marathon, I wrote a really long letter to break up with him. I was so sick. I wanted to be sick by myself. I didn't want to be seen like this. I was embarrassed. I felt like I was just this empty person, this shell, and I couldn't give anything to anyone. And I wrote that letter to him and we sat down to talk and I was going to break up with him, but thank God he does not. And he stayed with me and supported me. And now we're engaged, which is great. So, you know, right around then when I had wrote this breakup letter, I had what you would call an intervention of sorts. And at this point, you know, it's pretty visible. Like Amy had said that my pictures clearly were showing that I was no longer healthy, but no one's saying anything. You know, everyone's saying something to you while you're doing all these quote unquote great changes. But now when it gets to this point, no one's saying anything. But thank God my sister Juliana and a very good friend of mine, her name is Karen, they did say something. I think what they did was they didn't say anything about my body or eating or what I looked like. I don't think it's ever really the best to comment on people's bodies in general because, you know, you never do know what they could be going through. They could be dealing with a diagnosis or a stressful time in their life or, you know, an eating disorder. And they never said any of that. They both just in their own way said, hey, you're not the Lauren I know anymore. You're just not you. And that was kind of what did it. I started to try to deal with the mental illness because, you know, I had a mental illness. I have anxiety. I was sick with therapy because it was really just about being okay with letting go of this perceived control. I also had this really incredible dietitian. Her name is Nikki. She was incredibly patient with me and very kind. And she gave me a lot of great material, which I still look through to this day. But I do think that recovering from this eating disorder was one of the hardest things I have ever done in my life. I count myself extremely privileged and very fortunate that I had access to all of this support because I know that not everyone does. And especially now, it's been very abundantly clear that there are disparities in our healthcare in this country. But I did. And even though I did have all of this support, it was very, very hard. I was rewiring my brain to trust my body again. I went through a very long period of time, multiple days, where I just ate enormous amounts of food because my hunger and my fullness cues were gone. They were lost. And my brain was just thinking to itself, this girl, she's going to stop eating again. So we need to eat as much as we can right now because we don't know when it's going to happen again. So those nights I spent just like physically ill, like very, very bloated because I had just eaten so much. And those things were usually things like cookies and bread and peanut butter, like sugar, carbs, and fats, which are things I'd completely eliminated from my diet that my body just desperately needed. And it was horrible. I'm not going to lie. It was extremely hard to wake up those mornings and not want to just restrict again because I knew that that would give me the instant gratification of feeling better and being in control over this, these changes that were happening to my body. And I honestly never thought there would be a time where I ate normally again, but slowly I did have days where I'd be eating and I'd be like, oh, you know what? I'm full. I'm going to trust myself to just put this down now and it'll be there later if I still want it. Or, you know, I'm actually craving a piece of fruit today rather than a cookie. And those days where I was just constantly thinking about food and dieting, they slowly start to diminish until one day they're just thoughts that I don't act on. And then one day those thoughts aren't even there. But I do think that process probably took almost 2 years.
Wow. That, I know I keep saying wow, but these are amazing things that you're telling us and so important for people who have or are going through what you went through. Can you, for our listeners, list some of the support groups that they might be able to find to help with this rewiring process, which sounds like it's a major part of dealing with an eating disorder?
Yeah. You know, some of the materials that helped me, one was, you know, get a therapist if you can, because it is a mental illness, and also get a dietitian if you can, because, you know, they'll really help you work through these changes in your body. But, you know, I know that not everyone can do this. Unfortunately, our healthcare system is making this so that not everyone has access to it. So there are a lot of people on the internet putting out some great content. I encourage you to visit my Instagram to find all the people that I follow, but some really great dietitians on there. A woman named Lauren Ross, her handle is at How to Eat RD. Sammy Brondo at Veggies and Chocolate. And this woman named Evelyn Tribble, who's kind of one of the founders of Intuitive Eating, which is kind of how I think about eating now. She has an Instagram. She wrote a workbook that I worked through completely. It does ask a lot of weird questions about food, but it does really help you kind of think about your relationship with your body and food. And, you know, one of my favorite things about intuitive eating are the principles of it. And one of them is gentle nutrition. And that's basically the thought that you know, certain foods are just going to make you feel better, like fruits and veggies. But sometimes you just really want a peanut butter cup or an ice cream cone or, you know, burger. And, you know, that basically says, yeah, of course you can have all of those things. It will always be there for you. Don't be afraid of having it. You have total permission. But then, you know, there's also these things that make you feel physically good. And it's just a really nice way of thinking about foods, because a lot of people label them good or bad, but in reality, food doesn't have morality. And I think another thing I'd like to say is that, you know, eating disorders don't have a look. They affect everyone. They're not just affecting, you know, white women. Everyone is affected by them. And it doesn't always stem from body image issues. It can come from other things like food insecurity or living in a food desert or other social determinants of health. But no matter what you look like or what you're struggling with, everyone deserves equal help and support, because everyone suffering or living with an eating disorder does deserve recovery. And there is a life past your eating disorder, and it's awesome.
Wow, that's great. I'm going to look up this intuitive eating. I tend to overeat with stress, but I'd like to, as you say, food's not moral. It's not good or bad. We put a label on it and we use it, and then we whip ourselves over how we've dealt with it. So that actually sounds like a very important resource. Amy, do you want to add something now to the story?
Yeah, I mean, I want to emphasize what Lauren just said is so important. And I really think it begs repeating that this can happen to any person from any different walks of life. And obviously it's something that touches every aspect of your life. You know, this whole process, kind of watching it from the outsider's perspective, it was gradual. It didn't happen all at once. Remember, this is a story that unfolded over a period of at least 2 years, to my recollection. And from the time that Lauren and I kind of reconnected on Instagram, following her through these ups and downs, I mean, it's clear that her process of recovering hasn't been a linear one. I think even after she ran the first marathon and she clearly hit her nadir with weight, it seemed that she started becoming a lot more transparent and more forthright about what was going on with her on the other side. And I would encourage everyone to follow Lauren though at Recovery Runs on Bagel, because she's an excellent writer. And she does these really beautiful long blog posts with her photos. And she's been, I think, you know, very vulnerable and very honest about the process. And I know that can help other people out there. It's even for someone not going through an eating disorder, it's helped me on days where I've had, you know, high stress or high anxiety, just to know that we all may be doing different walks of our lives, but we all feel and share that burden. And so it's been a nice sense of community to kind of follow Lauren along on her journey. And, you know, and as her friend and as someone who's known her now for, we're rounding out about a decade, it's been a real joy to see her come out of this, because Lauren is so smart and she's so strong. And it's been really rewarding to watch her on her journey, even if it's just, you know, finishing a run or deciding today I'm not going to do a run, I'm just going to sit on my couch all day, or I just had this great looking bagel sandwich and I'm going to share it with you guys. And and one of my favorite posts recently, especially during the last year when she was actively trying to put her weight back on and still be healthy and still training for, I think, a second or a third marathon, if I'm not mistaken, was that she was finally putting on some muscle mass. And so she got really excited about her baby muscles when her little biceps started coming up and posting photos of that. So like I said, it's a really great account, and she has a lot of good resources and just is a really excellent writer. And yeah, it's just been a lot of fun to watch Lauren succeed at this. And she's a very successful person. And I think anything she puts her mind to, she's going to be able to accomplish. So yeah, that's what I wanted to add to her story.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's very important. Lauren, I think, you know, when we first got together, I know Amy asked you a very important question that sticks in my mind. And she said, do you consider yourself recovered or in recovery? And you've just described an eating disorder relating to an anxiety disorder, but something that becomes almost like a gambling addiction, an addiction to these numbers. So
yeah.
Are you recovered?
I think that if you want to call yourself recovered, you should, because everyone's journey is different and you should feel empowered to own that story. For me, I still have days where I wake up and I do have to like actively fight back on thinking about an eating disorder thought that comes up, and I have to say, no, that's not what we're going to do. So I like to say that I'm still in recovery, but I am okay with that.
That's important to hear. And I think that's important for people who are recovering to hear that this is not, I woke up today, I had an intervention, I realized this was wrong, and so now I'm well. That this is a process and can continue for some time, and that's all right. And that's all right.
Mm-hmm. And Mary, I don't know if you know this, and Lauren, I hope you don't mind me sharing, but Lauren has a couple of tattoos that I think are really interesting. And Lauren, I've always wondered if, I know the situation surrounding when you got these tattoos, but I wonder what they meant to you at that time. And now being in recovery, if they mean anything else to you.
Oh, this is a great story in the stories with.
Yeah. The first tattoo I got after I ran my first marathon was a Liberty Bell with the 26.2 in it. And I think when I got that one, I did it for the show. I ran this marathon and it was just a bucket list item. I just, you know, I'd done it. That was it. I was sick. It was kind of meh. Like, I got this tattoo, but it wasn't this boom. I got this tattoo. That was awesome. But the second tattoo I have is the Chicago skyline with the 26.2 in it, because I ran the Chicago marathon a little over a year after the Philly marathon. I actually did it, you know, in the middle of my recovery. I was 30 pounds heavier than when I started the first marathon, and I actually ran it 7 minutes faster. And I got that tattoo because that marathon was a blast. I had so much fun. I was so happy. I was so much healthier. And I lived that marathon experience. You know, even though Philly was my first marathon, technically, it almost felt like getting that tattoo was a celebration of my actual first marathon, because I was thriving and alive to experience it.
Wow. That's a very nice happy ending to a long story that started happy, but went through some very difficult times. And you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, we have been living in a time of a lack of self-control and high anxiety over, you know, what will happen next with the pandemic. And we're, I think, approaching the light at the end of the tunnel, but we're not quite there yet. There's still an anxious time. So I hope anybody out there who's feeling the stress of an eating disorder that's been worsened by the pandemic, or an eating disorder period, will look up Recovery Runs with Bagels and look up Intuitive Eating and some of the other resources. So thank you both for telling us this very important story from the inside and from the outside. I have to say that I like to pick some theme music for the closing of the show. And one thing that we all agreed on that would be very special would be to play some music from a performer that we lost way too early to an eating disorder. And that was Karen Carpenter. So you will hear her at the end. She had a very difficult and exacting professional life. And sadly, she died way too soon. But now, don't you dare move, because we have another great KPFT show following us. Yep, coming up next, you'll be loving the very cool Lars and the Tennyson Tapes right here on Houston Community Radio. So make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, tuning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear.
Keep loving these great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. And on top of that, as I mentioned before, we're going to add some photos from Lauren's Instagram onto our Facebook page so that you can get a more physical feel for the story. So in closing, this is Mary E. And along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want to thank our wonderful storytellers tonight, Lauren Badalucco and Amy Spallone, and especially for sharing a very personal and important story. We want to let you know, and Lauren especially knows this, that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Just begun.
The Pacifica Foundation utilizes station boards to progress its utilization by the communities it serves. KPFT's local station board has many committees you can participate in or just observe. Participation by the public is encouraged. Committees include finance, outreach, management selection and review, and other critical decision-making bodies. The local station board members serve on these committees where business is conducted using Robert's Rule of Order. To view a complete schedule of listed meetings for all Pacifica, including those for KPFT, point your browser to kpftx.org. Attending meetings is a good way to engage, and many have become more interested in board service by taking this step. Pacifica listeners that pledge a minimum of $25 per year get to vote for its board members. Become radioactive and become a listener member. Hit that support button at kpft.org. Thank you. From 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1, Houston.
Did you know that you can double your value to KPFT? As a listener sponsor, by volunteering your time at KPFT, you can increase KPFT's shareholder value. Yes, you heard correctly. That's corporate speak for improving productivity. Certain corporations will match your volunteer hours with money. That's right. Your volunteer hours translate into dollars so that you've basically doubled your value to KPFT. Yes, time is money. So roll up your sleeves and lend a hand. Thank
Thank you for supporting KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace.
You will have the opportunity to vote in a referendum for 30 days starting June 7th to replace the Pacifica Foundation's bylaws with new bylaws proposed by a group of Pacifica members. If adopted, significant modifications will be made to the Foundation's governance structure affecting both the national and local station boards, including how you, as a listener sponsor, are represented and can participate. To assist you in navigating the complex issues, a graphics-based voter guide